President Trump visits Wisconsin. Bill O'Reilly is forced out of Fox News. Tensions with North Korea are flaring again, and Wisconsin takes the first step toward drug testing some Medicaid recipients. Just a few of the issues we'll discuss with our two guests during this edition of The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. So what would you like to talk about? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guests today are Ruth Conniff, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning.
And Van Mobley is with us, an associate professor of history and economics at Concordia University, Wisconsin, president of the Village of Thiensville, and also a columnist for the Ozaukee News Graphic. Good morning, Van.
Good morning, Joy.
And you were, Van, with On Point, Public Radio's On Point program last night in Milwaukee. And that program, by the way, will be rebroadcast at 10 o'clock this morning. So if you want to hear Van twice, you can listen to On Point at 10 o'clock. You were talking about race and the Trump administration during that program, right, Van?
We were. It was a very nice evening. I can't say enough good about it. I enjoyed it immensely, and I was very flattered and honored to be a part of it.
Well, and we're honored to have you here today with us and with Ruth Conniff. Let's start with President Trump's visit to Wisconsin this week and his stop in Kenosha. He signed the Buy American, Hire American executive order. He also said that he will order federal agencies to look at tightening a temporary visa program used to bring in high-skilled foreign workers into the U.S. Van, starting with you, what do you think these moves are going to do? Are these going to be good for the economy?
I think that the moves are a continuation of his theme in the campaign of putting America first. I think that it was good that he came here. I liked everything about the his trip. The one thing that I would add as a tweak for him to do better in the future, I think whenever he began to give his talk, he had a lot of nice young workers behind him, and then he brought up a lot of Wisconsin politicians around him later, and that's where the picture that was sent out to the press a lot of times. I think, frankly, he should have just kept the workers behind him and made the main and made them the focus of the picture.
Yeah, Ruth, your thoughts on what President Trump did in Kenosha?
Well, Trump likes to have these campaign-style rallies, and he particularly likes to have them when he's not doing well with his base and with the public, and he's not doing well right now. His approval rating is at a historic low for any president at this point in their term since they've tracked it. And he's got some issues with the people who were enthusiastic about him when he was running for president because he hasn't really been delivering. So it makes sense that he would come to Kenosha, an area that he won narrowly in the presidential election, and that's sort of representative of the white working class Trump supporters who really appreciated his message on trade and nationalism and the idea of bringing back jobs and remembering forgotten workers. But he posed at Snap-on, a plant that doesn't make anything in Kenosha anymore. And I think that's sort of representative of the fact that this was, you know, more of a photo op than a substantive issue. And then the policy that he announced, the executive order that he signed, in addition to being sort of rank hypocrisy because it curtails a program that is mainly a program for bringing Trump wives to the United States, the H-1B visa program until Melania got here, you know, it affects high-tech workers. And those folks aren't working in Kenosha. So, you know, he talked a lot about low-wage immigrant labor hurting American workers, and that's not really the issue with this H-1B visa program. So it's, you know, it's a lot of showmanship, and it doesn't really substantively address the issues that he raised and that his base is really worried about.
I would just disagree with Ruth a little bit about that. There are multiple occasions in which the H-1B visa program has been used, and they bring over workers, and then they make the high-tech workers or just American workers, they make their trainer replacements, and then the American workers are gone. So that's happened repeatedly. I think that this this executive order will help restrain some of that corporate behavior.
Yes. Well, it's true that there is a segment of H-1B visa recipients who work for outsourcing firms. And the big story that was so galling for a lot of Americans was reading about Disney employees training their replacements, and their replacements were these folks who came in on these H-1B visas. But that is really not, first of all, it's not happening in Kenosha, and it's not related to the flight of manufacturing, which is a big issue there. And in his new bill, you know, Google and Facebook are really happy with the result here because they're going to continue to be able to bring over the workers that they are bringing over. So the impact of this, you know, for folks who came out to see Trump in Kenosha is pretty much nil.
Yeah, Trump did signal support for Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin's proposal to require certain public water infrastructure projects be built with U.S.-made iron and steel. That proposal was added to a different bill last session, but was ultimately taken out by House Speaker Paul Ryan and GOP leadership. Is this an area where Trump and GOP leadership will clash, Van?
On this issue, it very well may be, and I support Tammy Baldwin's bill as well, and I support Trump, and I think that this is an area where you could potentially get some bipartisan agreement, and I think move forward. I'd also combine discussion of using American products on some of these infrastructure bills with Wilbur Ross, and they're looking at steel dumping. Both of them, I think, are very important, and so I hope we make some progress in that area. Yeah. And that is good for manufacturing jobs, Ruth.
Ruth?
Yeah, I'm with Tammy as well. I mean, these are real issues. This is not, you know, the issue is not that global trade hasn't hurt workers or, you know, that we don't need to do better, that the United States shouldn't manufacture products or that people should be in the spiral that they're in. Trump, you know, really, really talked to people about an issue that they care about a lot. And it happens to be an issue that Tammy Baldwin has also been talking about for her entire career. You know, I was in Washington, D.C. for spring break, and there was a big Washington Post story about Tammy that implied that in her run-up to her reelection campaign, she's borrowing these talking points from Donald Trump, which only a reporter from the Washington Post could believe, because, you know, this is a really important issue in Wisconsin, and it's one that Tammy Baldwin and other progressive Democrats have talked about for a long time. And I think, you know, it's true that there could be some bipartisan consensus on these issues. And the question is, you know, what's actually an effective policy?
The president is closing in on 100 days in office, that milestone that we all pay attention to all the time. And while his first major legislative push, the repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act, did not get off the ground, reports emerged this week that a second attempt at a health care deal may be coming. And Trump was saying that if not next week, shortly after that, one that might allow states to get waivers eliminating the so-called community rating provision, or the rule that prohibits insurers from charging higher premiums to people with pre-existing conditions. Ruth, what do you think of this renewed health care bill?
You know, I mean, Trump is aware that his 100 days is up at the end of this week, next week. And so there's this rush on to try to hurry up and repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, which in its first attempt was a complete disaster for the Republicans. And had it succeeded, would have been a complete disaster for at least 24 million people who the Congressional Budget Office estimates would lose their insurance. So, you know, this new plan is not an improvement. The Republicans are between two choices that are both bad. They can actually succeed this time, which is unlikely, and, you know, have millions of people lose their health care, many of them the very people who voted for Donald Trump. Premiums will skyrocket. They've got Paul Ryan has cooked up this new idea that we're going to have these risk pools for people with pre-existing conditions, something that's actually been tried in the past already and causes huge increase in premiums for those folks. So, you know, this plan is going to do a lot of damage to people. So they can do that and see how that helps them in the midterm elections, or they can fail again, which is the more likely scenario. But, you know, there's no good options for them here.
Yeah. So, Van, what do you think of this renewed push for health care reform?
Well, I am a pragmatist, and I learn from the past and what I observe. And I will say this about Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan has been associated with a series of disasters on a legislative level. He really gummed up President Bush and President Bush's second term with the Social Security reform. He didn't help Romney when he ran. He was on the vice presidential ticket. He fouled up Barack Obama when he and Obama tried to do the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think that Trump carried the state of Wisconsin in large measure because Ryan was not heavily on, was very ambiguous on whether he supported him or not. I think if Trump wants a health care revision or repeal and replacement or an improvement of Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, he needs to probably get something that Paul Ryan is not going to support, and then it will go through.
They can't ram this thing through by the 100-day mark. And I think most Americans do not share that as a major ambition for restructuring the healthcare market.
That's what I said. You know, I think that there is a bill to be gotten out of the Congress. It may not be one that Paul Ryan can support, but I think Donald Trump needs to get a bill out of the Congress.
Joy?
Oh, I'm sorry, you don't hear me. Last weekend, protesters in Washington, D.C. and cities across the country took part in tax day protests, which demanded that President Trump release his tax returns, something that he has refused to do. Says he's under audit still. Numerous polls since the election have found that a majority of Americans want President Trump to release his tax returns. So, Van, should he?
I think we've talked about this on numerous occasions. This seems to be an issue that it really doesn't resonate with me. I don't know. Maybe it resonates with other people. I think he ran and he didn't release them. I don't really care, but other people continue to bring it up.
Yeah, well, because of the protest, Ruth. Do you think he should, or do you think he will?
I mean, it's astounding, really, that he continues to take this posture that he, while being willing to completely restructure the tax code in a way that, frankly, would mostly benefit him. You know, we just did an infographic at the Progressive website about how many pizzas people would get under the, you know, if you translate the tax breaks that Trump is proposing into pizzas. And he gets so many pizzas, it fills up almost the entire screen. The average middle-class family gets a half a pizza in this tax break. So meanwhile, as far as the details of Trump's taxes go, we don't know because he's the first president in modern history to refuse to disclose what's going on with his own taxes and finances. And, you know, it goes to a basic level of trust.
Yeah, at a town hall this week, a Republican Congressman Sean Duffy was asked about Trump releasing his tax returns, and he said, "I think those should have been disclosed." Does that surprise you, Ruth?
No, I think that is a position that most of the American people can support. I mean, it's really it's an outlier position to try to defend a president hiding his personal finances, particularly when he's got family members who are on his staff who have business interests in foreign countries, and they're, you know, involved in negotiations with those countries about American interests. I mean, there is a very significant worry about self-dealing in this administration, about corruption, about U.S. policy being influenced by the Trump family's personal financial interests. So, you know, only a Trump is really going to be able to make a full-throated defense of secrecy. And they're closing the White House logs now. They don't want the public to know what's going on in there. And that's not really a position you can go out in public and defend.
So, Van, do you want to add anything, or should we move on?
Well, I'm more interested in tax reform than looking at Donald Trump's taxes. And actually, I think that they should get a health care bill. I told you what I think they should do on that. I think they should drive toward health reform, and I think this is where they'll be able to get a bipartisan agreement. I think they need to keep some sort of a border adjustment tax in place. They need to cut the payroll tax and lift the cap, and they need to cut the corporate taxes. I think that sort of a tax reform with some health care reform will drive investment and bring back manufacturing jobs to the United States. They need to do it now, and they need to stop talking about it.
We will take a short pause, and then when we come back, we'll talk about a number of other top issues in the news this week, including Bill O'Reilly's ouster at Fox News, escalating tensions between North Korea and the United States, and much more. Is there an issue you want to talk about? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Talking in this edition of the Week in Review with Ruth Conniff, editor of the Progressive Magazine, and Van Mobley, associate professor of history and economics at Concordia University. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with two guests from different perspectives about the top stories in politics this week, and we're welcoming your views on the issues of the week and the issues you want to talk about at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Craig in Onalaska is with us. Hi, Craig.
Good morning. My comment this morning is that I think Donald Trump is kind of the wrong way Corrigan of presidents. And if you remember your history, wrong way Corrigan was a pilot that flew to New York and then he was supposed to fly back to California. He was unable to get a permit to fly from the U.S. to Europe.
Yeah, Craig, I'm sorry.
Europe.
Yeah, so.
But my point is Donald Trump knows that science, taxes, his ability to be commander-in-chief, Russia, and the inauguration are all things that he has been absolutely wrong on, and he knows that he's wrong.
Van, I guess a response from you on that, and I'd like your, you know, assessment on how Trump has done in his first 100 days as we are approaching that milestone.
I don't think Trump is a wrong way Corrigan or whatever. I do believe that it's very difficult at this juncture in American history to get consensus to do anything. So I think if Hillary had won, for example, I think that there would have been an enormous amount of just what we've seen in Washington, which is dysfunction and gridlock. I think that what Trump is very good at, and he's a developer, is to keep pressing until he gets something that will go through and work and will move us forward. I just think that maybe he's discovered that there are some paths that are not going to be very effective, and that may very well be it's ineffective to try to, you know, pass legislation with only Republicans, and therefore he's going to have to, you know, devise some new policies and have a little different approach. And I think that that's what he should do. I think that that's what he will do. So I wouldn't say that he doesn't know which way to go. I'd say that, you know, this is kind of a harsh process of trial and error. And I expect that he will make progress. Yeah. On the stuff with the Russians, you know my view on that. I think the Russians are the way Russians always have been. I don't think it's in our interest to generate a situation domestically, politically, where we can't deal with the Russians effectively in foreign policy. And I think that one of the unfortunate byproducts of the last election cycle is one of those type of situations is developing. I think we'll all rue the day if we don't move away from that path.
Do you think, Ruth, that President Trump knows which way to go?
Well, you know, the analogy that the caller made to Wrong Way Corrigan, the first thing I thought of when I heard that was the supposed armada of, yeah, U.S. warships that Trump announced this week were headed towards North Korea. And, you know, there was a lot of alarm about provoking this nuclear-armed country and what that might mean and taking this aggressive posture. But the real news turned out to be that Trump had no idea what he was talking about. Those warships were not headed towards North Korea, and he didn't even know it. So, yeah, I think that he doesn't know where he's going, and I think that that's become increasingly evident. And it's a reason that, you know, remember on the campaign trail, Trump kept talking about all this winning that he was going to do and all this winning, and everyone's going to be so sick of winning all the time. Well, he's lost on every major initiative that he's announced so far in these first 100 days. He lost. He tackled health care reform. He outsourced it to Paul Ryan. He didn't notice what was going on. On the eve of its defeat, he didn't know he was in trouble. You know, he's lost on his immigration ban, had no idea the backlash that he would stir up, and the courts were against him. And, you know, there's news today about this four-hour private dinner and White House tour that he had with Sarah Palin, Ted Nugent, and Kid Rock, who were themselves amazed that in the middle of, you know, these major foreign policy crises, Trump has time to walk around the White House and shoot the breeze with Ted Nugent, who said they had a significant foreign policy discussion. So, you know, I mean, at some point, it's pretty clear that this guy is not governing our country.
What did you think of that photo op, Van?
Oh, I think that that's part of his. I would have lumped that in with some of his other push here to appeal to some of his base constituency. You know, Sarah Palin is. I know that Ruth probably is greatly irritated by Sarah Palin. She doesn't irritate me. I think Sarah's fine. But I think that he needs some legislative accomplishments. I would say getting through the Supreme Court was a big accomplishment. Neil Gorsuch, who had one of his first really participations in the justice system as a Supreme Court justice, I think that was a big accomplishment. And I would just go back to what I said earlier. I said, you know, they don't seem to be making any progress, but I wouldn't ascribe all of that to Donald Trump. Some of that I would ascribe to the normal suspects in Washington, and he's going to have to learn how to work around them. And that may mean alterations in his continuing alterations in his staff until he gets people who are capable and willing of working around legislative roadblocks and personages.
Let me ask you, Van, about, and since Ruth talked about this airstrike armada that the president said was on its way to the Korean Peninsula, and it was supposedly a show of force. Don't provoke us, and don't fire off a missile. And then we learned that it wasn't any. It was actually traveling in the opposite direction. It was doing some sort of military exercises with Australia or something. What do you make of that?
I think that's poor staff work at the Pentagon and at the White House.
Yeah, so you don't blame
the president.
But Donald Trump is responsible.
You don't know what he's going to say at any given moment. I mean, they are dealing with a president who randomly tweets things that aren't true, and then they have to scramble to cover for him. It can't be a good job.
Right.
Jaws dropped. You know jaws dropped when he made that completely random back pocket statement.
No, but I will say that the latest news is that Armada is on its way to the Korean Peninsula.
And, great.
And it could be.
Now we're heading into this potential nuclear confrontation based on that. I mean, you know, holy cow. Hang on to your seat.
Well yeah.
Now what happened, and this is, I mean, I don't know what happened, but this is what I expect. Maybe someone was told, or what was happening is they deployed they had a regularly scheduled training thing with the Australian Navy out in the Indian Ocean. The Carl Vinson was going there, and then when after that's over, then they were going to swing it up to the North Korean around and just wave the flag there. You know, I don't know, but there is a foul up there in communication in the Pentagon and the White House, and they need to straighten it up.
Well, also, it is. I mean, there was a lot of tension last weekend when it was wondering if North Korea was going to, you know, test fire off another missile, and it did, but it failed. And now, in an escalating war of words with the U.S., North Korea warned yesterday of a super mighty preemptive strike that would reduce American military forces in South Korea and the U.S. mainland to ashes. So, Ruth, what in the world?
Well, you know, I mean, North Korea is ruled by an autocratic, narcissistic madman. And these kinds of statements have been floating across for a long time. The scary thing is that on the other side, we now have an administration that's saying things like what Vice President Mike Pence said, the era of strategic patience is over when it comes to U.S. policy toward North Korea. We don't want to get into a nuclear war. I mean, this is not a good time to be flying by the seat of our pants. And, you know, it is a real worry, I think, to a lot of American citizens that the Trump administration seems to be over its head and seems to be, you know, hot-headed.
Yeah. What should the U.S. do about North Korea, Van?
The North Koreans have been this way for a long time. You're very limited in your options. They're relying on the Chinese to see what the Chinese will do. Frankly, to be honest with you, if you wanted to make progress on the North Koreans, you would need not only the Chinese to help out, but you would also need the Russians. And That's just the way it is. The only way to make progress in this area is diplomatically. And even then, I think it's limited. I just think you need to set your expectations realistically and then live with a constant irritant. That's what the North Korea is, and it's what it will remain.
We are talking with Van Mobley and Ruth Conniff during this edition of The Week in Review. If you have a comment on the news of the week, or if you'd like to bring up another issue that is making headlines, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Eric in Madison wants to talk about North Korea. Hi, Eric.
Hi. I think the president's inability to negotiate, his inept, his inability to intellectually negotiate a peaceful resolve with North Korea only leads to one thing, it's just military force, and that's what really scares me. His intellectual capacity is just beyond belief, and I'll take your comment off there.
Well, do you have a comment, Ruth, first?
Yeah, I just want to add one thing on North Korea. I mean, I think there's only so much time you can spend pointing in disbelief at Donald Trump. But North Korea failed in that missile test because the Obama administration had set up a cyber program to disable their nuclear weapons tests. And so really, if he was honest, Donald Trump would acknowledge that it was the Obama administration that has slowed down the North Korean nuclear program. And that's really, in addition to diplomacy, I completely agree with Ben, that's the only route here. That's really what's going to have to happen to prevent, you know, total disaster. And the worry is that Trump is going to get into a macho fest and a spitting war with this crazy man, and we're going to get into a nuclear war. So I think it's important to note that the United States policy has actually, under the Obama administration, been dealing with North Korea on a number of fronts successfully.
Andrew in Beaver Dam, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, I tend to disagree. With North Korea, we had a conflict there for about a decade. We've tried diplomacy for over 40 years. Diplomacy clearly has not worked. There's still a dictator there threatening our livelihood here in the United States and our allies abroad. Personally, I'd rather see us strike them first before they strike our men and women on the South Korean peninsula or allies. And I'll leave it at that. I'd like to hear your comment.
Van, you want to comment?
I just see the past history. I read it in a different way. I think the North Koreans have been there for 40 years, and they may be there for another 40 years. But we haven't had a war on the Korean Peninsula since, you know, the early 50s. I don't really see an imminent one, despite all the rattling that the North Koreans are doing. If I had to guess, I would suspect the North Koreans are trying to extort some money out of us, which we've given them in the past in a variety of ways, although we've never really liked to say that. I think that this is just an endemic problem, which should be treated as an endemic problem, and it's not one of the things that when I look out on the world, that I would spend any more resources than necessary to clear up, because I don't think that it can be. I think the cost of clearing it up by, you know, removing the regime is prohibitive. But I think that about a lot of other regimes as well. And in that, I certainly supported the Iraq War, but in retrospect, I wish I had not. I was not in favor of the Libyan toppling of Muammar Gaddafi, and I am not in favor of toppling Bashar Assad.
Let me take Sandra in Mount Pleasant now. Hi, Sandra.
Hi. I wish Van would set partisan politics aside and recognize that this president is inept. He doesn't know what's going on because he doesn't really care what's going on. He just wants everybody else to do the work for him. And the Supreme Court justice, they did get that person in, but they changed the rule to do it.
Yeah, and Van, I wanted to talk about Justice Gorsuch making his first decision last night too. But you want to comment on that
about getting him through?
Yeah, that she said that they had to change the rules, and it wasn't that big of an accomplishment.
Well, changing the rules. You know, some people might say that that things would work better in Washington, and you would be able to get some legislation through on a bipartisan basis more easily if, in fact, you could just run a majority through the Senate. That would, you know, that would certainly alter the way it functions. It would strip some of the leadership in the Senate of some of its power. Whether they wield their power effectively or for good all the time, I don't know. It'd be interesting to have Chuck Schumer on and ask him what he thought about just getting rid of the 60-vote rule across the board. The answer he gave you might surprise you.
Let me ask about Justice Gorsuch in his first major action on the U.S. Supreme Court last night, casting the deciding vote to let Arkansas begin executing a group of death row inmates. Gorsuch joined his four fellow Republican appointees, Chief Justice John Roberts, Justices Clarence Thomas, Anthony Kennedy, and Samuel Alito in the majority. They did not explain their reasons. The justices in the minority didn't think that the state of Arkansas had to rush into these executions to try to use a execution drug that was about to expire by the end of the month. Ruth, you have a reaction to that that first decision?
Yeah, I mean, it's horrifying. You know, I mean, I think the United States is moving towards a better place in a bipartisan way on treatment of prisoners, on mass incarceration, and on the death penalty. And, you know, hurrying up and killing somebody because a drug that has been associated with really grotesque side effects is about to expire and the pharmaceutical companies won't supply it anymore because they're so horrified by the pain that it causes. This is not any kind of a victory for any kind of sense of justice. So, you know, it was grotesque. You know, and there's news today, actually, out of Louisiana, which is interesting. It's about a case that was in Brian Stevenson's great book, Just Mercy. He's an amazing death row lawyer. And it's, you know, there's this man who was accused of murdering his son. It turns out his son died of pneumonia. He was on death row and scheduled to be executed. The extremely right-wing Louisiana Supreme Court vacated his conviction, set him free, and he's not going to be recharged. He's completely innocent. And, you know, it's these kinds of cases that really have cast a shadow over the death penalty, which is barbaric anyway. And my hope is that even though we now have Jeff Sessions and, you know, he was a pretty horrifying character, that the right-left coalition on reform for criminal justice in this country has really gathered a lot of steam in the last several years, and that we will continue to see some kind of progress on these issues.
Yeah. And Van, your thoughts on this first case that Justice Gorsuch ruled on?
Well, I didn't follow the details of it very much, but if it's the 5-4, then that's what we'd expect the lineup to be. I mean, that's really what he was selected to go on the court to do, and I guess that's what he's going to do.
We're going to take a short break, and then we have still a lot of things to talk about, including, as promised, the news about Bill O'Reilly being ousted from Fox News over those sexual harassment allegations, and a lot of state news, too, that we should talk about. And we welcome your questions and your reactions and the issues you want to talk about at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with two guests from different perspectives about the top news stories of the week. Van Mobley is with us today, Associate Professor of History and Economics at Concordia University. He was also with On Point last night, and you can hear him again after 10 o'clock in this Milwaukee program that will be aired. And Ruth Conniff is also with us. She is editor of The Progressive magazine. Well, Bill O'Reilly's career at Fox News came to an abrupt halt this week. The top-rated cable news host was forced out weeks after a New York Times article detailed a series of sexual harassment allegations and the settlements made in those cases. The network faced increasing pressure to cut ties with O'Reilly after more than 50 advertisers pulled out of his show and ultimately did so on Wednesday. Van, what was your reaction to this news?
You know, that's the second one that they've gotten at Fox. And You know, wow, I wish I might harass you, Joy, if I could get $25 million in severance. I mean, because I'd split it with you. How about that?
Well, and you're commenting on Bill O'Reilly getting $25 million to have his contract bought out. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Bill O'Reilly deserved it? Is that what you're saying, Van, and he didn't deserve the severance?
I mean, I don't know what's happening at Fox. Clearly, they're shuffling their lineup, and Megyn Kelly they got rid of. Now they're getting rid of O'Reilly. They got rid of Roger Ailes back in the summer. Who knows why these press people do the things that they do, and whether it's all just publicity and press. You know, it's like the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey. What is it? They load up the wagons and the show moves on.
So, Ruth, I'm guessing you might have a different reaction.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, I know Bill O'Reilly, and I was a contributor at Fox when I ran the one-person Washington office of the Progressive.
I didn't know that.
I actually, I worked for Fox. I spent a lot of time there. I was on O'Reilly's show, knew Roger Ailes. And, to me, this is really an interesting unfolding story. It's really the end of an era. And the magnitude of the egos of these men and their total deafness to other people, their belief that they are invulnerable and they can treat people however they want, what's changed really is corporate culture. And Rupert Murdoch was willing to hang on to them. O'Reilly was not pushed out because he wasn't bringing in ratings. He was bringing in massive ratings, the highest ratings that network saw. So what happened to him is that the younger generation of Murdochs were not willing to put up with this madman corporate culture. The world has changed. Women are not willing to be grabbed. They're not willing to be told that they have to have sex in order to advance in the workplace. That whole culture of arrogance and abuse, frankly, it's under scrutiny now, and these guys can't believe it. They can't believe this is happening to them. And it's interesting that it's happening at Fox. It shows that despite being such a blowhard and all of that posturing and all of that chest beating, their day is over, and they can't continue to behave this way. And that's good news for a lot of women who work at Fox News.
Does President Trump face any repercussions for saying that Bill O'Reilly is a good guy and that he doesn't think he should have settled?
Well, President Trump, it was a huge blow to an awful lot of people who are just have decent values when President Trump was elected after being caught on tape bragging about sexual assault and using the foul language that he used to describe how he likes to manhandle women. And, he is part of that culture. And there's this kind of what I believe to be culturally kind of a last gasp that's represented in the Trump administration of the offended male ego and the desire to be on top and to treat people how you want. And it can't last. Demographically, it can't last. There's a whole generation of young people who aren't putting up with that stuff. And it's going to go. And, I don't know whether it will be Trump's downfall ultimately as well, but that's where we're going. We're not going back to those days.
Yeah. And
on that one, I would like to get in a point on that, on Ruth. President Trump apologized for his comments, and I accepted that apology, but I certainly do not
on behalf of the women he manhandled, you accepted his apology.
I did. And I voted for him because of the issues that we've spoken of repeatedly.
He said very little, and there's really nothing you can say. You listen to what he had to say, there's really not much to be said to reel that back in. And it's why his own, GOP compatriots abandoned him in droves and then came back with their tails between their legs and endorsed him when he was the clear winner. And that is going to have long-term political repercussions. In fact, it just did when Chaffetz had to quit his job. Constituents don't like it. People don't like it. It's not just women who don't like it. Men who don't really appreciate that kind of crudeness and nastiness. People who are family values conservatives, you know, there's just an awful lot of America that's not buying it.
What do you mean, Ruth, about, I wanted to bring up the Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz will not seek re-election in 2018, currently serving as chair of the House Oversight Committee, and he has... he's not going to run again. Why did you bring him up in that context?
Jason Chaffetz was one of the Republican congressmen who said after that tape of Trump bragging about manhandling women that he couldn't look his teenage daughter in the eye and support him, and he was not going to support Donald Trump. And then when Trump became the clear winner, he reversed himself in an embarrassing move, and he's been paying the price for Trump's election ever since. He thought he was going to chair the House Oversight Committee and spend the next 4 years being a star on Fox News leading investigations of Hillary Clinton. Instead, he's stuck defending Donald Trump. So he goes back home to town halls, and he's booed by constituents who think he's a hypocrite. And he's in a thankless job where he's constantly trying to backpedal and apologize and explain things that Trump does in a role where he's supposed to be a watchdog. So he quit. He just walked away from the job. It's damaging to him politically. It's a very big job. It was a very sudden resignation. And, you know, he is a casualty of the Trump era. People around Trump are having a hard time finding their footing, and he's one of them.
What do you think of that, Van?
I think that the Congress would be well served if they actually stopped worrying about Trump so much, held some hearings, and passed some bills, which they don't do anymore. And what caused Mr. Chaffetz to leave? We'll find out. Maybe he just got tired of it.
Yeah, we really should talk some state issues since we're talking about people not running for things. One more Democrat has announced that he won't be running for governor in 2018. Dane County Executive Joe Parisi has joined a growing list of somewhat well-known Democrats, including Congressman Ron Kine, former State Senator Tim Cullen, who say that they will not challenge Governor Walker next year. So, Ruth, any concern here about whether Democrats are going to be able to field a candidate? Who's left on the Democratic bench?
Well, they need a candidate, there's no doubt. You know, you can't win an election without a candidate. You know, the state Republicans are really enjoying this, and they're making a lot out of all of these people stepping away. You know, I like Joe Parisi a lot. I don't know that the Dane County executive is the best choice to run against Scott Walker. I think that the Democrats really have to think about rural areas of the state. People that I've liked, Jen Schilling, who also took herself out, I think would be a better representative just because she is she's from La Crosse, and I think that she has a certain amount of cred in areas where the Democrats need to rebuild some credibility. Gwen Moore from Milwaukee, going in a totally different direction, may run. I do think it's possible to make the case to rural voters that you care about their issues and you know their issues, even if you're not from a rural area yourself, so I wouldn't count that out. Obama did very well with rural voters in Wisconsin. Julie Lassa from Stevens Point is a possibility. Kathleen Vinehout, dairy farmer from Alma, is still probably planning to run. People like the idea of Tom Nelson, the Outagamie County exec. You know, there are still people out there whose names are being floated and who haven't made up their minds.
Oh, by the way, State Senator Kathleen Vinehout will be joining us Monday during our state capitol report after 7 o'clock. We'll talk state budget, and we'll also talk about whether she's got some plans to run for governor. Van, what are your thoughts on the 2018 gubernatorial race?
I think that people are reluctant to run because Scott Walker is a seasoned veteran. He's a tough politician, a tough campaigner. He wrote a budget to shore up some of the areas where maybe he would show some weakness, and he's going to be tough, if not impossible, to beat for a Democrat, and that's why they don't really want to run against him.
Yeah. Another story we wanted to talk about, that this week Wisconsin is moving closer to mandatory drug testing for some Medicaid recipients. They are asking the federal government, Wisconsin is asking the federal government for a waiver in order to do this, to implement the testing of childless adults on Badger Care. Van, do you think this we should do this?
Well, I was reading, I was kind of reading around in the story. I'm not entirely sure that I completely understand exactly what's going on. But I would say this, if you're going to drug test them, then if you should then provide, it seems to me that you should provide support to them if they turn up bad, at least for a period, because that's one of the things we want to do is address the opioid crisis. We want to help people get off it if they are on it. But the other thing, too, which always, this Medicare, Medicaid debate always is kind of puzzling to me, because the truth of the matter is, if you kick people off this stuff, they still go to hospitals and they get care, and it's just kind of a false debate. But that's it. So I'm not entirely sure that I understand everything that's going on here.
Well, according to the news reports, that if someone would test positive, that person goes into treatment paid for by the state is the way I understand it, too. But, Ruth, what do you think of this?
I think it's mean. I think that it's a way of trying to humiliate the poor because you qualify for Medicaid, now we suspect that you're a drug addict. I think it's erecting a barrier to treatment. It's trying to scare people away from getting health care, who are probably the people who most need it, addicts. We should treat that as a health care issue, not as a criminal matter. You know, it's basically criminalizing health care. It's moving away from a sensible solution that has been, you know, the bipartisan direction of dealing with opioid abuse. So I just think it's bad policy, and it's based on a mean-spirited attack on people who are vulnerable.
Also this week, Republican state lawmakers reintroduced a proposal to bar the state from providing insurance plans that cover abortion services, with a few exceptions. One of the bill's sponsor, Republican State Representative David Craig, said the bill isn't saying you can't have this procedure, abortions, done. What the bill is saying is that state taxpayers shouldn't have to pay for it. What do you make of that, Van?
I read the it seems to me that I'm not entirely sure on this one either what it actually seeks to accomplish, because if you look at the language, I think if you boil it down and actually pragmatically you put it into practice, I don't know that it would change that much about the way that it currently operates.
Yeah. Ruth?
Well, it would, because it's not, you know, that's a very misleading endorsement that you quoted. It would not say state taxpayers don't have to pay for abortions. It would say that any health care plan that provides abortion services is no longer available to women in Wisconsin. So it would have a major impact on what kind of health care and what kind of insurance women who are not having abortions, not seeking abortions, would be able to get. But it's also just more of this hypocritical meddling in people's lives by a party that's supposed to be about getting government out of people's lives. And it's really, you know, I'm with Chris Taylor, who said in the Florida debate, she just finds it so degrading to women, the suggestion that they never need an abortion because of a health care issue, that it's this elective thing that they don't need. Because, you know, as she demonstrated when she had so many women speaking on the floor about the agonizing situations that they were in, people are in tough positions and they should be able to make these decisions privately, and these guys in the legislature should stay out of their business.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Ruth Conniff is the editor of the Progressive Magazine, and Van Mobley is an associate professor of history and economics at Concordia University, president of the Village of Thiensville, and writes a regular column for the Ozaukee News Graphic. And Van will be On Point after 10 this morning, a program that was recorded last night in Milwaukee. Well, thank you for listening, and thanks to Chris Molina for producing this program. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.